Morning, we would entitle Empathy for the Depressed, Dangling, Destitute. Empathy, what is it? Definition: the ability to understand and share the feelings of another. The ability to understand and share the feelings that somebody else is having. A Bible verse that defines empathy, Hebrews 13:3. Remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. Someone that's in bonds, think about them as if it were you, as bound with them. And them which suffer adversity as being yourselves also in the body. Someone that's suffering adversity, emotional problems, physical problems, pain, anguish. Farther than putting your feet in their shoes and walking in their shoes, the verse says put yourself in their body. That's empathy. To be able to feel what they're feeling like they're feeling it. Now that's a hard task. So often nobody knows how somebody else is feeling. But we can try to imagine. Try to pray that God would help us to understand the feelings of others, and go farther than sympathizing, but just actually think about that situation. What if it was me? What if that was me? Would I look at the situation different if it was me going through that, as if it's somebody else I'm looking at going through that? Empathy is that ability to understand and feel what somebody else is feeling. And when you understand and feel what they're feeling, you may approach them and the situation a mite differently. Empathy, it's an important thing. The word's not in God's word, but the concept is in God's word. How to show empathy? How to show empathy? I jotted down a few things. How to show empathy? Listen. Be a listener. Oftentimes, that's one of the best things you can do for a troubled person. Lend an ear. Just listen. Listen patiently. Listen with true concern. It's easy to look at somebody's face sometimes and see whether they're really, really interested in me. Listen like it matters. Listen. Withhold judgment. Withhold judgment. Don't be a judge. Just be empathetic. Care and concern, not judgment, is called for. Don't look down on. Don't talk down to. Don't think down about. Don't look down on them. But by the grace of God, it could be you. Don't talk down to them as if you're better than them. And don't think down about them. Sometimes it's hard to hide what you're thinking from the way your face is looking. Don't even think those thoughts. It's not just don't say those words, don't think those thoughts. Look down or think down about them. Contemplate yourself in their shoes. That's how to show empathy. Contemplate your own sin and unworthiness. That's a key, I think. And finally, contemplate, but by the grace of God, it could be me. It could be me. It could be me. Don't ever forget that. When you're looking at somebody else and their troubles and their case and their situation, be a good listener. Don't be a judge. Don't talk down to. Don't think down about them. Realize what we are in and of ourselves. A whole big batch of sinners. And don't think you're better than somebody. But by the grace of God, it could be this sinner going through that, what that person's going through. So we think about empathy, and we'll go to some Proverbs. So some Proverbs and some verses in the Proverbs that mention the word poor, P-O-O-R. From this word poor, we're going to learn some things if we'll understand what that word poor, who that's talking about. and what that case is in God's Word in the book of Proverbs, when it says poor, who's it talking about? Is it just those that don't have enough money to buy food and clothes? No, it includes those. But don't take the word and limit it to those who don't have dollars. Let's look at Proverbs 14:20. The poor is hated even of his own neighbor, but the rich hath many friends. Is that not true to life? Is that not human nature? The poor is hated of his own neighbor. You don't have time to fool with him. He's not my problem. It's his own fault. He should have been like me. Yet a rich man approaches. Got all the time in the world for you, mister. Come on in, come on in. I want to spend some time with you. Don't want to spend any time with a poor man. Oh, more than willing for a rich man to show up. Like to be in his company. The poor is hated even of his own neighbor, but the rich hath many friends. That word poor means destitute and needy. Destitute and needy. That may be destitute and needy of natural things. That may be destitute and needy of spiritual needs. We want to try to develop that thought this morning. The poor aren't just the ones without money. The poor are the ones who are destitute and needful of something they're not getting in this world. I think Jesus called it poor in spirit. Poor in spirit. Proverbs 19:4. Wealth maketh many friends, but the poor is separated from his neighbor. You say that's saying the same thing, and it is. And I would have not been redundant and used two verses to say the same thing, except it's not saying the same thing if you understand the original word that's translated poor in these two verses. The first verse, the word was translated from a word in the Hebrew language that meant destitute and needy. This word, poor, wealth maketh many friends, again, the same thought. The wealthy has all the friends he can stand. He has more friends than he wants. But the poor is separated from his neighbor. He's all alone, like the sparrow alone on a housetop. But this word means dangling. Dangling. By implication, weak or thin. Those who are dangling, hanging on by a thread. Dangling. That's a sad thought, isn't it? That somebody's just hanging on in this life. Dangling. So we've talked about the destitute, and we've talked about the dangling. And both those are described by this word poor. Those who are dangling. Just the whole thought bothers me. But I look around and I see people who are dangling. And sometimes I can become a dangler. Have you ever been one? Trying to hold on and your grip's slipping and the thread's breaking and you don't have any place to turn to. At the end of your rope, dangling. These ideas about hanging on by a thread and at the end of your rope, that describes people that are dangling. That's what the word's describing, those that are just hanging on. But maybe their grip is not going to hold much longer. Proverbs 19:7. All the brethren of the poor do hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He pursueth them with words, yet they are wanting to him. Nobody wants to talk to him. Again, that's the word destitute. 29:7 Proverbs. The righteous considereth the cause of the poor. That's the dangling. But the wicked regardeth not to know it. A righteous man, a man who's living right, a person who's living the way God would have a person to live in this world, what does he do? He considers that one who's dangling. He considers the cause. There's a cause here. Is there not a cause, David said, when he went to fight Goliath? Is there not a cause in front of us all the time? Those who are dangling, is that not a cause for Christianity to take up? Not just Christianity in general. Is that not my cause and my calling in this world? The righteous considers the cause of the poor, but the wicked regardeth not to know it. Just shut my ears to it, close my eyes to it, put on my blinders. I don't want to know about it. It bothers me to think about it, so I just won't look. Is that human nature? Am I the only one that feels that way? If I really am honest with my own heart and my own feelings? Wouldn't I rather be around somebody that's upbeat, than a dangler? Phew. You know that upbeat rich guy? That man who knows how to do folly in this world? He got a crowd. And that dangler, destitute, desperate, all alone, all alone. Proverbs 31:9, the last of the Proverbs that we'll go over. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor. This is yet a different word. This word, from the original Hebrew word, meant depressed in mind or circumstance. Depressed in mind or circumstance. One, somebody who's down and out, depressed, discouraged in their minds because of their circumstances. What are we supposed to do? Open thy mouth. Maybe say a prayer for them. Maybe go talk to them. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, plead the cause of the poor and needy. That word means a sense of want, especially in feeling. There's something they're needing in their feelings. Their feelings are hurting. And what was the other one? They're depressed in mind or circumstance. The righteous takes up that cause. Those who judge righteously plead the cause of the poor. Natural thinking. The neighbors hate them. The friends walk away. To the family, they're a black sheep. No time for such as that. Life is better than having to deal with that. You know, somebody else that's having troubles, how should we look at that? Let's think about a little baby, a little infant baby. You know what little infant babies are prone to do about 2 o'clock in the morning? They're prone to wake up crying. And you know what that little baby's biggest problem is? He can't even tell you what's wrong. She doesn't even know how to get the words out so you can know. Is it a diaper? Is it a bottle? You try both of those and nothing works. And you hold the baby and you rock the baby and you sing to the baby and nothing works. And it's 4 o'clock in the morning. Remember, this started at 2. And that poor desperate baby cannot even put into words what the problem is. And that's who you're dealing with. Now the world has two options there. A good mama just keeps rocking and keeps loving. And doesn't discard that baby and keeps taking up that cause. I don't know what to do. But I'll be with you. You know what a bad daddy does? He finally gets fed up and he shakes that baby and destroys that baby's brain because he quit caring. He might have started out caring, but 2 hours is a long time. It's not that long. That baby's life is in your hands. That person's life is in your hands. There's a cause. Are we going to shake that person in frustration and despair, our own frustration and despair, or are we going to patiently keep on trying to figure it out? What's going on here? How can I help? Plead that cause. Hold that child of God. Be a neighbor that continues to be a neighbor and not a what neighbor that walks away. Actually, the book of Job, chapter 6, as I'm reading through the book of Job in days of late, chapter 6 is what grabbed me and shook me and put my mind on these things. And these things haven't left my mind since reading chapter 6 of Job a few days ago. Now, to understand a little bit better about what we're going to find in chapter 6, I want to go back and I want to set the stage. It's a stage that you know, but perhaps going back here and thoroughly reviewing Job's case might help us to understand Job's case a little better. We've got a lot of details about Job's case. Sometimes the cases we face in this world, we don't know all the details. I want to tell you, Job didn't know all the details of Job's case, nor did Job's friends know the details. We've been given insight to those who that were involved in the situation directly did not have. Remember that. But so that you'll know Job's case, it's not ever a waste of time to read God's Word. Let you do some reading here. Throw in a few remarks and review in our minds, refreshing our memories, Job's case in this world. his situation. Job chapter 1 begins with the words, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job." Goes on to say he was a perfect man, upright, feared God, hated evil. He's a good man, a real man. Remember that. He's a real man. This isn't some kind of story with a lesson. The Bible is history. The Bible is history. Now, there's lessons from this history, but the Bible's a strange book. It's a history book. The stories of Christ, that's history. The story of Job, that's actual history in a world event. World historians, they don't record such individual stories oftentimes, but God records for us an individual story of a real man named Job, who was a good man. Remember that. He was a good man, as men go. One of the best probably that's ever lived in this world. Verse 7. "The Lord said unto Satan, Whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord, From going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it." God and Satan having a conversation. "Where you been, Satan?" "I've been all over the world, walking up and down, heading to and fro." "The Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil?" It's God who brings up Satan to Satan, the man Job, the good man Job. "Have you thought about Job, Satan? Have you considered his case? Have you looked at him? You've been going all over looking for folks. Look at Job." Satan's been looking. He knows all about Job. He answers the Lord, "Doth Job fear God for naught?" You think Job's just serving you because he's that good? You're paying him well. He's not serving you for nothing. You're paying him to serve you. What does that mean? Does Job serve God for naught? "Hast not thou made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land." You've given him possessions. You've made him a rich man. You've made him a blessed man. You're taking care of him. God, you put a hedge around him. I can't get to him. No wonder he likes you. His goodness is of ulterior motive. He's doing it so you'll keep on blessing him. Don't you see that, God? Satan talking to God, telling God how it all is. You quit paying him. You quit blessing him. You quit rewarding him for serving you. You take the hedge down and let me to him, and you just see what happens. That's Satan. God brought it up, remember? That's Satan's response. It's your fault, God. If you'd back off, he'd break. Satan goes on, "Put forth thine hand now and touch all he has. He'll curse you to your face." The Lord said unto Satan, "Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand." So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. You can have everything he has. You can touch anybody he loves. You can touch everything he's got. Just don't touch him. Don't touch his body. That's the only hedge I'm keeping. That's the only chain I'm putting on you, Satan. Don't touch Job directly, but you can take away anything else he's got. You can do whatever you want to otherwise. Oh, my goodness. Have mercy on us, Lord. Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from evil. Don't turn Satan loose on me. God turned Satan loose on Job with one restriction. Verse 14, "There came a messenger unto Job and said, The oxen were plowing, the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, "The fire of God is fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." While he was yet speaking, a parade of messengers. "There came also another and said, The Chaldeans fell upon the camels and have carried them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." Three servants survive from all of his employees to keep all those flocks and all those herds. All the flocks, all the herds, all the camels, all the oxen, all the sheep, all the asses, all the possessions gone. Three messengers, you're broke. You have nothing. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. 10 children, 7 sons, 3 daughters, dead. You think the livestock news hurt? You think being broke after being the richest man in the East? These are his children. In one stroke of time, they're gone, dead. Verse 20. Job rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, Naked came I out of my mother's womb. Naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job sinned not or charged God foolishly. What a saint. What a servant of God. What a man of integrity. The Lord gave him to me. The Lord's taken him away from me. I'm still going to worship the Lord. I'll still worship the Lord. That wasn't the end of the test. Chapter 2. The Lord said unto Satan, From whence cometh thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, From going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. Satan's still busy, on the job, all the time, looking for somebody to destroy. The Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in all the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil, and still he holdeth fast his integrity? Although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause? Have you looked back at Job? Of course I've looked back at him, says Satan. Satan answered the Lord and said, Skin for skin. Yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. You didn't let me have him. You didn't let me touch his flesh. You didn't let me make him hurt in his body. Put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. The Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life. Don't kill him. If there was ever a man close to death, it's Job. You can take him all the way up to death's door, but you can't make him walk through that door. Can you imagine how that would feel? To be that close to death's door for an extended time. If we read through this book, we're going to understand this lasted a long, long time in a real man's real life. That he's that close to death's door. Don't kill him. That's your rule. That's what I'm putting upon you, Satan. You can't go that far, but you can go right up to that. Don't take his life. Verse 7, chapter 2. So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord, smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown, from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. And Job took him a potsherd to scrape himself. That is a broken piece of pottery. A sharp edge on a broken piece of pottery. Perhaps not as sharp as broken glass, but probably had pretty much of a knife edge on it. And Job takes this broken pottery, this potsherd, and scrapes his flesh. A man's hurting pretty bad when he scratches himself with broken glass. And some way, was that easing the pain? I don't know. I don't know why he did it. I've never seen a man that desperate. Never seen a man hurt that bad. Never seen a case like Job's case. Verse 9. Then his wife said unto him, "Dost thou retain thy integrity? Curse God and die." That's what Satan said he could make him do. Twice he said, if you'll take away all he has, he'll curse you to your face. If you'll let me at his body, he'll curse you to his face. Now his wife, the woman who's one with him, the love of his life, the one who stands with him, supposed to, she says, go ahead and curse God and die. It's almost like she's on Satan's side, as if he's in her head now, telling her, encourage him to break. I've almost got him. If you'll say that, he'll curse me. His own wife says, curse God and die. But he said unto her, Job said unto his wife, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. He retains his integrity. His wife says, why retain your integrity any longer? What's there to live for? Curse God and die. You'll be better off dead. Job understands that. We're going to get to that. But Job still maintains his integrity at this point. Through this book, you're going to find where Job had some cracks. I understand that. And we're not going to get that far in our study this morning. But up till now, Job is hanging on to his faith in God and to his worship of God. Now then, our scene is set. It's been long enough that word has spread to different countries. This is one place I'm going to. I think we might could go to other places, but this is how I'm knowing in my mind, thinking in my mind, assuming in myself, that this is lasting a long time. This is not a fly-by-night acute illness that he's going to get over in a day or two if he'll just hang on. It's been going on long enough that word has spread. Have you heard about what's happening with Job? And they didn't have phones to call people. It's word of mouth over distant miles that the word is spread. There's not a case in this world like Job's case. That message is starting to spread, and it gets to Job's friends who live in three different places. Verse 11, chapter 2. And when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, and they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. The messengers have spread and given the news to these three friends. The friends have sent messengers and they've communed with each other. They've made an appointment together that we'll go see him. We'll go together, we'll meet at Job's house and see him. That's taken a while, I do believe. So that's their plan. They'll go in an attempt to comfort him. We'll find later they are miserable comforters, but that's their plan. Their intent is good. They care. I think they really care. I think they really care about him. They just don't deal with the situation very well, we're going to learn. When they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, there he sits, and they don't recognize him. No wonder. They knew him not. They lifted up their voice and wept. They're weeping over the case of their friend. And they rent every one his mantle, a sign of mourning. They just tear their cloak. They rent his mantle, sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. In dust and ashes, they rent in their mantles. They weeping for their friend. What a case. So they sat down upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. That's a long time for four men to sit looking at each other. Think about it. 7 days and 7 nights, they're sitting looking at their friend, and he's looking at them, and nobody says a word. For 7 days and 7 nights, that may have been the best week they spent with Job. They're sitting there crying, looking at his agony, but not saying anything. Job breaks the ice, chapter 3. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed his day. Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there's a man-child conceived. Verse 10, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, Why died I not from the womb? Why couldn't I have just been stillborn and never seen the light of day, a man in despair? Verse 20. Wherefore is light given to him that is in misery? Why do I keep on living? And life unto the bitter in soul, which long for death, but it cometh not, which rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. Chapter 3, Job expresses, I wish I just didn't exist. I wish I had never been born. I wish I could now die. I don't like this world. I don't like life. Destitute, dangling, depressed. Chapter 4. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, Who can withhold himself from speaking? What might he have said? He hadn't said anything yet for a week. 7 days and 7 nights he hadn't said a thing. How about starting out with, Job, I'm sorry. Job, I care. Job, I love you. Would those have been a bit comforting, perhaps, to a man in such mental, emotional, physical agony? Job, I care. Eliphaz is so burning to speak, he cannot withhold himself any longer, he says. And verse 3, Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands, but now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. Oh, my goodness. What did he say to him? Job, what's wrong with you? Stiffen up. Why don't you just carry the load? Be tough. Get over it. Wow. Do we sometimes have that attitude toward the destitute, dangling, depressed, destitute? Get over it. It happens to everybody. Now you're fainting that it's happening to you. I don't think it happened to everybody like it happened to Job, but I don't care. Whoever it's happening to, that's not the right approach. Get over it. Verse 7. Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off? They that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. By the blast of God they perish. First of all, his first advice, get over it, man up. Quit being a wimp. Second advice, it's your own fault. God never put anything like this on anybody that didn't already deserve it. If you weren't such a big sinner, this wouldn't be happening to you. You know the story. Job's not the big sinner. Eliphaz made that assumption wrongly. Wrongly he made that assumption. What does God tell Job at the end of this book, the last chapter? He speaks to Eliphaz and his friend and said, You've spoken about me things that are wrong. You've spoken about this situation ways that are wrong about it. You didn't know what you were talking about. Verse 12, chapter 4. Now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a little thereof, in thought from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon man. Then a spirit passed before my face, the hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying, Shall a mortal man be more just than God? What's this man claiming now? I have wisdom from the spirit world that you don't have. I've seen a vision. I have understanding you don't have. I know things you don't know. He claims to have had a vision from the spirit realm to teach him to speak what he's speaking right now. And God, you remember I told you God's going to later tell him, you didn't speak the right things. I don't know where his vision came from, but he's acting like he's somebody and knows something special, that I can tell you some special things from God. I've seen a vision. I'm somebody. You just need to listen to me. You need to man up. You need to shape up. And I've got authority to tell you this because God showed it to me in a vision. Oh my goodness. What a way to approach the desperate, the dangling. Shall mortal man be more just than God? Behold, listen to these words. This is horrifying. You know what he tells him in these next few verses? Let me give you a preview. He's going to tell him in these next few verses, God doesn't care about you. You're not important to God. Oh my goodness, is that what you need to tell somebody that's dangling, hanging by a thread? God doesn't care about you. God's got better things on his mind, bigger fish to fry than you. Listen, behold, he put no trust in his servants and his angels he charged with folly. He doesn't even pay attention to angels. He thinks they're foolish. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay? You think God really cares about people? We know better. Jesus hung on a cross for us. God cares about you, but that's what Eliphaz is telling Job. God doesn't care about people. They are destroyed morning and evening. They perish forever without any regarding it. God's not paying any attention to us. Call now if there be any that will answer thee. Cry to God. He's not listening anyway. He taketh the wise in their own craftiness. It's your own fault. You've been sly and fooled the world, but you hadn't fooled God. He knows you're a sinner. Therefore despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty, for lo, this we have searched it. So it is, hear it, and know that it is for thy good. I've searched these things out. I've seen visions from heaven. I know what I'm talking about. God doesn't care about you. He didn't know what he was talking about. It's because of your sin, Job. He didn't know what he was talking about. Man up, Job, and be a man and quit being a wimp. He didn't know what he was talking about. He's told him things he didn't know anything about. He's approached the situation in the wrong way. He's coming to those who are in despair, discouraged, despondent, depressed, suicidal, wishing he could be dead. And he's approached the situation with that kind of comforting words. Chapter 6. Oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances, said Job. For now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up. The terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. Doth the wild ass bray when he hath grass, or loweth the ox over his fodder? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? The things that my soul refused to touch are my sorrowful meat. O God, grant me one thing that I long for, even that it would please God to destroy me and cut me off. What is my strength that I should hope? And what is mine end that I should prolong my life? What's he saying right there? You know what? I have no idea. Well, I'm the preacher. I'm supposed to know. What's he talking about, the white of an egg? No taste in the white of an egg. Where are you coming from, Job? What are you saying? When I read these words, this is what grabbed me. I don't know what Job was saying. It's almost like it's a stream of consciousness. Some writers have written in that style. It's terribly difficult to follow when a writer's writing a book, and what he's expressing in that book is what the person's thinking, the character, and all of a sudden, her hair smells funny. Why is that gate locked? And you don't know what thought it had, and you don't know when he had that thought, and you don't know why he had that thought, and it's just a stream of thoughts that you don't even know what it's saying. I think sometimes that's what happens to those in despair. There's a stream of consciousness there and you don't even know what it is. I went to the commentators trying to find out what this means. And they didn't know either. Somebody said he really wasn't talking about the white of an egg. He was talking about the froth on a glass of milk when you pour it out. So, what does that say? I don't know. Somebody said he really wasn't talking about the white of an egg. He's talking about the spittle that runs down from a madman's face when he's slobbering at the mouth. How do you get that from white of an egg? I don't know. You know what I came to the conclusion? I don't think anybody knows what Job was talking about. Maybe only Job knew and he couldn't put it in words. He's like that baby who's hurting and he doesn't know how to say what's he feeling. Is that not the case sometimes with people who are dangling, destitute, in despair? They're trying to say what's wrong and they can't even say what's wrong. The words aren't there. The thoughts aren't there in any way that can be expressed. I don't know what's wrong. But it's like the white of an egg that doesn't have any taste to it. I don't know. I just sat and thought about these words. And this man trying to tell him what he's really feeling. And he goes to the thought of white of an egg. Maybe when we get to heaven, we can ask Job, what were you meaning? How did it feel to feel like the white of an egg? I don't know. Something about that grabbed me and shook me. The desperate despair of a dangling, discouraged person who compares himself in some strange way to the white of an egg. What a case. What a case. I don't know why God just doesn't destroy me. What is my strength? What is my hope? He comes on down. This chapter continues. Chapter 6 continues in this stream of consciousness kind of thing. There's other places he talks about snow water that's ice cold, but then the people reach to drink it and there's nothing there. The army goes to the water and there's no water. And this stream of consciousness that just seems so disconnected as I read through chapter 6 and think, Job, why did you go there? Why did you go here? What do you mean by that? But I do find things in here that do mean things to me in chapter 6. He looks at his friends and he says, To him that is afflicted, pity should be showed from his friend. Why don't you just pity me? Why don't you care? Where's your empathy? In verse 27, yea, ye overwhelm the fatherless and you dig a pit for your friend. You haven't lifted me up, you've dug a pit and buried me. The chapter comes on down in verse, go to chapter 7. Is there an appointed time to man on earth? Are his days not like the days of an hireling? As a servant earnestly desires the shadow, as a working man desires the end of the day, sunset so he can quit, and an hireling looking for the reward of his work, payday, a day off maybe, a weekend. Is life not like that? Can I not have a weekend? Can I not just quit? Can it not be over? Wearisome nights are appointed to me. I lie down and I arise in the night. When shall I arise and the night be gone? That's the thought he has when he tries to go to bed and get some sleep. He can't sleep. He's afraid to be awake. He's tossing and turning. My days are spent without hope. The thoughts of Job continue for chapters and chapters. Bildad answers this time in chapter 8. Another friend. How long wilt thou speak these things? How long are you going to keep on going? Why don't you just shut up? Doth God pervert judgment? If thy children have sinned, maybe it was their sin. If thou wouldest seek him betimes, if you'd been a praying man, he was a praying man. It tells us that in chapter 1. We didn't read that. If you'd have just been a praying man, this wouldn't have happened to you. If you were pure and upright, surely now God would awake for you. He'd hear you. Verse 20, behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers. You better not be calling to God. He doesn't have any time for you. That's Job. A piece of the book of Job. A tiny portion of 42 chapters, I think it is. That described the depressed, dangling, destitute. You know who else was that? You know whose case was worse than Job's case? Your Savior, Jesus Christ. Isaiah 53 and 2. When we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Why would I want to be around him? That's what they did when he came. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. We hid, as it were, our faces from him. Remember the poor that has no friends and his neighbors won't open the door for him? We hid, as it were, our faces from him. Oh, if he'd come into the world as a rich man, he'd had lots of friends. He came into the world as a poor man, poor in money, poor in spirit, humble, meek, and lowly. And people hid from him, ran from him, didn't have time for such a man as that. He wasn't any fun to be around. We hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not, wouldn't look at him. John 1 and 11, he came into his own received him not. Mark 9 and 12, as it is written of the Son of Man, that he must suffer many things and be set at naught. He's nothing. To be set at naught is to be thought of as nothing. They thought of him as nothing, a nobody. No time for him. turn your face away from him. Comes to his own won't receive him. John 19:5. He's wearing the crown of thorns. He's before Pilate. He's got the purple robe on. And Pilate brings him forth bruised and battered, beaten and whipped, buffeted with fists and having received the Roman whip and this mockery of an outfit upon him. And Pilate said, "Behold the man. Look at him. Look at him. He's worthless. He's nothing. He's nobody. Behold the man." Beyond all this external suffering and rejection by men, he's hanging on a cross, and God the Father, there's darkness upon the world, and God the Father looks away from him and he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? My own received me not, and God turned away from me, and he's all alone. And God looked upon the suffering. The Bible says at that point, I think it's when this happened, God looked upon the suffering of his soul. A body hanging on a cross, and the agony, the physical pain, the suffering we cannot imagine, but the suffering of the body did not amount to near what the suffering of the soul in that man was experiencing. God didn't look at the suffering of his body, though God knew about that. God looked upon the suffering of his soul. I think this man had a suffering soul from the time he came into this world till he hung on that cross. It hadn't suffered to the extent at that point because God had been with him. Now God turns away from him and there's a suffering soul. They said of Job, God doesn't care. Jesus kind of experienced the time that God did turn away. God said, he'll never leave you nor forsake you. Jesus said, God, you've forsaken me. And his soul suffers. Who's Jesus here? He's the depressed, dangling destitute. He's that poor man that needs a friend. Would you come to him? There's all kind of people we could come to that are here now. Do we come to them? I'm judging myself, not you. His own words, Jesus' own words, Psalm 22:6, it's in prophecy, but it's his words. The psalm is about what he's saying when he's on the cross. He says, I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men, despised of the people, and they that see me laugh me to scorn, they shoot out the lip, they shake the head. They're shaking their head in disgust at me. Did that bother Jesus? That's his words right there. That bothered him. That bothered him that they shook their head in disgust at him. It bothered him that he was reproached to men, that they despised him. They thought of him as a worm. He felt to be a worm. That's his feelings about himself. He felt like he was wormy. Low as a worm. Psalm 69:20, again, words of Jesus. Prophetic words, but they're his words. Reproach hath broken my heart. God with a broken heart. I am full of heaviness. That's depressed, dangling, destitute. I'm full of heaviness. I looked for some to take pity. I wanted somebody to care. I needed somebody to be a friend. But there was none. I looked for comforters, and I found none. That's Jesus Christ, your Savior. He's living what you live when you feel to be this character. He knows how you feel. The Bible tells us that. There's no feeling. There's no temptation. There's no trial or trouble that can come upon you then. But what he knows how it feels because he's been there. You think Job suffered? Nobody suffered like Jesus suffered when God did turn his back away from him. Jesus knows suffering, and he knows your suffering particularly. He knows not just how it feels. He knows how you feel when you feel it. He looks into your soul. He is touched with the feelings of your infirmities. He feels your feelings. He knows your case. He cares. If nobody cares, he cares. Take that home with you. That'll do you good. When nobody else understands, when it comes to the point that you can't even explain it, and you try to tell somebody about it, and you're talking about the white of an egg, and you know they don't understand because you don't understand, but God understands. Whatever that means, Jesus knows how it feels to be feel like to be a white of an egg. I don't know why that grabbed me so much when I read Job chapter 6, but that's what got me. But he couldn't express his feelings. He couldn't even tell us what he was feeling and how bad it was hurting. And he goes with some kind of stream of consciousness that takes him to a thought about a white of an egg. Wow. We don't know how people feel. We don't know how bad they feel. We don't know how lost they are, like the baby trying to say something but has no ability to even say and tell you what's wrong with them. Are you going to shake that baby? Are you going to try to rock that baby? You know what a Christian does? A Christian rocks hurting babies. You know what a man that loses his patience does? He shakes hurting babies. Who are you going to be? Who am I? Who am I? Christ does care. He said, let not your heart be troubled. Believe in me. In this world, you'll have tribulations, but I've overcome the world. And I've given you faith that'll let you overcome the world. What should the non-danglers? Now, you may be a dangler by tomorrow, but if right now you're not a dangler, if everything's going pretty smooth with you, and your case is not Job's case today, and you're not one that's depressed, dangling, destitute, let me give you a couple of verses, three verses from Matthew 25. This is the way Christianity faces the depressed, dangling, destitute. For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And they say, we don't remember doing that, Lord, when we do that. The king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you've done it to one of the least of these, my brethren, these little ones who are hurting, hungry, thirsty, naked, needing a visit, you've done it unto me when you do it to one of them. In years past, in days past, in my thoughts about those passages right there, those verses, I've thought about the physically hungry, the physically thirsty, those without enough clothes, those who are truly in prison, and I think we should think about those folks. I think it applies to those folks, but I think it's bigger than that. I think it's deeper than that. The Bible's a spiritual book, talking to our spirits, talking about our spirits to our spirits. I think some of these things are spiritual problems too. Don't ignore the physically hungry, but don't forget the spiritually hungry. Don't forget about those who hunger and thirst after righteousness and don't even know what it is, who wish they could be better. Jesus said, man doesn't live by bread alone. It's not just the natural food and bread you'd give somebody. Man doesn't live by that alone. Man lives by the words that come from my Father. What kind of father words you think? He's the God of all comfort. Your father's your comforter. Words from the Father be words of comfort. Sometimes they're not just hungry for food. They may be. But sometimes you're going to encounter people that are hungry for spiritual words of comfort. Man doesn't live by bread alone. Man can't make it by just with satisfied physical needs. Sometimes we have spiritual needs. That hunger for help. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. A cup of cold water to a traveler that's panting and needing a drink? Sure. Don't turn him down. What about that cold water for a thirsty soul? That news from a far country. Those are words from comfort. Words of comfort. He that is athirst, let him come. More than just a cup of water. Cup of love that'll quench the thirst of those who need cold water for a thirsty soul. Some good news from a far country. May the Lord give us the right words that would be that good news at the time of need for those who need such. What about I was a stranger and you took me in? Oh, yes, indeed. Don't leave a stranger on the street. It's dangerous these days, but the Bible says take him in. Be careful to entertain strangers, for some have entertained angels unawares. Sometimes it's not the angels that'll fool you. Sometimes it's the desperate danglers who are the strangers. Peter wrote a book, a letter in the New Testament, the book of 1 Peter, to the scattered strangers. To the scattered strangers. What's he tell us among many other things in that book? He says to show hospitality without grudging. Show hospitality, be a friend. Without grudging, without the look of martyrdom on your face, without the attitude of being better than somebody, just somebody that needs a friend, a stranger. Take them in. Befriend somebody today. Be a friend to a stranger. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. Adam was naked in the garden after sin was upon him, and he was ashamed. Ashamed of his nakedness in that garden. Hebrews 4:13. Neither is there any creature that is not manifest in his sight, in Jesus' sight, but all things are naked and opened under the eyes of him with whom we have to do. What's this talking about? Well, it's talking about the naked that need some clothes. Get them some blue jeans. He's talking about those who feel naked before God in their shame and disgrace of their sinful case. You know what that person needs? Don't go tell them God's not listening to you. Don't go tell them God doesn't care about you. Don't go tell them you reap what you sow. Now, why do you feel bad about being a sinner? You shouldn't have been a sinner. You know what you need to tell them? I know the Jesus that saves sinners. I know a Jesus not ashamed of you. You feel naked before his eyes, and he can see right down to your sinful soul, but he's paid for those sins. He loves you. He's your friend. I was naked and ashamed, but somebody put on a garment of righteousness as I look at my own conscience. Now, Jesus clothes us with that righteousness eternally, but you can tell somebody the story of Jesus and clothe them with some peace instead of shame. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. We've got an illustration, a factual history case in God's Word. Nehemiah comes before the king, and he's of a sad countenance. Nehemiah 2:1. I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said to me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. Then I was sore afraid. There's a lot in those statements. The point here is, I was sick and you visited me. There's more kinds of sick than body sick. The king, Nehemiah's problem, we won't even get into that, he's sad. He's sick of heart, his soul is sick. The king looks at him and said, you're not sick. I can see you're not sick, but you're sad. It must be sorrow of heart. And how does Nehemiah respond to that? At that point, when that king recognizes that it's a heart problem and not a body problem, that it's a soul sickness, Nehemiah begins to shake with fear. Because nobody understands soul sickness. If he'd been broke out with the measles, that king would have said, you go to bed, man. He's broke out with something worse than measles. He's got sickness of soul, and he knows that king's not going to understand such a thing as that. And he begins to shake with fear. As somebody's recognized his soul sickness, it's become public. He can't hide it any longer. That's what happens to the desperate danglers. Finally, it comes out, and you can't hide it anymore. And then you begin to fear because nobody understands this thing. Everybody understands the flu. Nobody understands depression. I was in prison and you visited me. We come back to our verse we started with. Remembering them that are in bonds as bound with them, not just physical prisons, not just being a physical prisoner, a prisoner of your own mind, a prisoner of your own case, a prisoner of your own situation. I was bound. You feel bound with them. Have empathy. Remember them that are in bonds as bound with them, and them which suffer adversity as being yourselves also in the body. Am I my brother's keeper? The Bible doesn't give an answer to that. But I think the Bible's answer doesn't give a direct answer to that after that question was stated in Genesis. Am I my brother's keeper? I could show you many verses that say, yes, you are. Yes, I am my brother's keeper. When they hurt, when you hurt, I should hurt. When you're dangling, I need to grab that rope with you. I'm not much, but maybe we can hold on together. When you're hurting, I need to listen. When you're hurting, I need to withhold judgment. When you're hurting, I could think, hey, I'm a sinner too. I'm not better than you. When you're hurting, I don't need to think down on you or look down on you or feel bad towards you. When you're hurting, I should think, but by the grace of God, your shoes could be my shoes. Your life could be my life. Your case could be my case. And with that thought, make that person's case your case. Grab the rope with them and help them hold on. May God bless us to see Christianity more than just converting the world, changing lives to be more like Christ. May God bless you. Let us stand and sing a song. Shake hands with one another if you'd care to. Offer the opportunity if you'd like to be baptized and become a part of this church. We'd love to have you. I apologize for going over. Please forgive me. That's what happens when you think about a sermon too many days. It just keeps growing in your head. Thank you for being good listeners. Let's sing What a Friend We Have in Jesus. Did somebody have one I should have offered? 237, I think it is, in the big red book. 237.